Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we are, the Lindsey Clancy trial. As of our recording here, we're still with a jury that has not come back with anything, very likely going to be hung. We're going to kind of tackle the conversation from that direction. But again, anything is possible here. But reading the tea leaves, the Lindsey Clancy trial is asking the hardest question in criminal law. Can a mother who killed her three children be held responsible when her own brain was the weapon used against her? 6 weeks of testimony, more than 80 witnesses, psychiatric experts who looked at the same woman, and some came to opposite conclusions. And now, after days in deliberations, 12 people have sent notes to Judge Sullivan indicating they are deeply split, making a hung jury look increasingly inevitable. Joining us today, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, to talk about what a potential hung jury would mean for Lindsey Clancy, whether this case would get tried again, and what it tells us when the system built to deliver justice stands on the brink and delivering no answer at all. Along with me, as always, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Eric, the jury has 80-plus witnesses, or they've heard from 80-plus witnesses, 300 exhibits, days in that room, and they've already sent notes saying they're struggling to reach a consensus. The judge has now read them the Tirid Rodriguez charge, which basically tells them no future jury is going to have better evidence than they do, and they still appear very deadlocked. I'm not honestly shocked by this. I think a lot of people have said this is going to be probably where it goes, considering the ether and the temperature in the room outside. It's a good gauge of what a jury room is going to look like. But they didn't have access to social media. They didn't have the conspiracies running wild, in their heads every day like we have. Are you surprised at all? What's your thoughts that we're sitting here with what looks like is going to be a hung jury?
Gosh, not a huge shocker to me, Tony, in part because of how polarizing this case has been. You know, when we talk with our family, we talk with our friends, colleagues about the case, there is a ton of middle ground. It's usually people are on the extremes of one side or the other. And so the jury is kind of a microcosm for society at large. And so that polarization may be going on back there. Folks have probably dug in their heels at this point in this stage of the deliberations. And I think it's reasonably unlikely that they're going to change their positions. However, I have seen it before.
You know, Eric, with that, you know, I'm just running my own thought experiments because, I mean, we're all right on this one. This has been the most polarizing case we've ever covered. And it's pretty profound about how, like you said, dug in people are on this. I can't imagine, especially with the coverage that's gone on, you know, the jury's supposed to sequester themselves and not pay attention. Hard to imagine they have, but in any event, so say it goes to retrial and they try to sit another jury. It's hard to imagine a scenario where it doesn't happen again. So in my mind, and this is what my question to you is, do you think they're going to press more for some sort of plea deal to avoid what they probably see as inevitable? And not just in this case, but is that generally what happens in cases where it gets this kind of severe notoriety, or maybe this is a landmark case for it just because it's risen to this level?
Robin, it's not uncommon at all for the attorneys, even during trial, even during deliberations, to be thinking about, hey, is there some sort of resolution that we might be able to come to? Because both sides have tremendous exposure. If Lindsey Clancy is convicted, she goes to prison probably for the rest of her life. If the prosecution loses, that's a tremendous black eye when you have three dead kids and you didn't do a great job. And so could both sides sort of come to the table and be like, hey, is there a way that we can sort of both get out of this relatively unscathed with some plea to a lesser whatever? Those discussions happen frequently during trial and even during deliberations.
Are you seeing any sort of leakage from either side of what you think either side would agree to? Again, I know it's pure conjecture. You're an armchair quarterback sitting back in this, but I'm just curious about, you know, what would either side see as a compromise win, do you think, from that point of view?
Gosh, it's a little hard to say. You know, the defense lodged what's called a lesser non-included charge that they required the court, or the court required the charge to be added of manslaughter. Perhaps, you know, that's less than first degree murder. It's less than second degree murder. It still carries significant prison time, but something that would give Lindsey Clancy a lot of life on the outside after this. And so that's a possibility.
Let's talk about those possibilities and logistically what that looks like if they come back deadlocked here, and just so we can have it on the record of understanding where their options are in this moment in time. Are there any roads, I should say, of which the jury can travel being deadlocked where this doesn't then get drug out through more hearings and a bench trial where both sides are able to come to the table relatively quickly and have some sort of settlement agreed to as to the outcome of this? Or does a deadlocked jury in this case mean, okay, we may get to some other resolution, but it means either a bench trial, new hearings that are going to further extend this months, possibly years down the road? Or is there something where in the container of this current trial and situation, even with a deadlocked jury, both sides with the judge are able to come to some sort of a resolution? Does that exist?
It could potentially exist. So the jury right now is deadlocked. If the judge determines that there's a hung jury, meaning they're not going to reach a unanimous decision, that's a mistrial. What that means is the prosecution can seek to set a new trial date and we could start all over again. Now, in the pendency of that new trial, during that interim, certainly if I'm defense, I'm going to the prosecutor and I'm saying, hey, look, you guys gave it your best shot. You guys had 80 witnesses. You had hundreds of exhibits. This lasted weeks and weeks and weeks. You gave it your best shot. You guys tried hard, but you couldn't convince a jury. There is no indication that you're going to get a different outcome if we do this again. So how about having her plead to something? And those discussions can take place while the district attorney is deciding how they might want to react next if there is a hung jury.
Yeah, do you see if they were to retry it, you know, as the prosecutors are thinking about retrying it, I mean, literally, what difference, what could they do differently? Because there are new testimony they could bring in. I can't imagine new experts because, again, part of the argument against the prosecution was the time removed from the interviews of Lindsey to the actual crime itself of killing her kids. And if they brought in more, there'd be even more time removed from there. So it's not like they're going to bring in new experts that have more depth of field necessarily, because again, experts seem to cancel each other out. The people standing with Lindsey saying that, yes, this is a break from who she was. And I don't see that shifting majorly in any way. So I guess what other new road could they go down? Would it be attacking the investigation, as we've seen so many of the wonderful people in the TikTok verse, you know, saying that they did a horrendous job of? I mean, literally, what more could they do than they've already done?
That's the thing, Robin, is basically speaking, the facts are the facts. Now, they could try to do some additional investigation. They could try to find additional ways to attack the credibility of defense experts and things like that. But by and large, the evidence isn't changing. The evidence is what it is. And so, you know, there's not going to be some kind of rabbit they can pull out of their hat during this second trial that I think would substantially change things. I just I can't see that.
And one more question on that. And again, it's the legal side. I don't know nearly as well as you, obviously. So say the prosecutors want to retry it because those two seem like, you know, I want her no matter what. Can the judge decide whether it gets retried or not? I mean, like, who makes that final decision on how to move forward with this case?
That shows how much power a prosecutor can have. That the decision whether to seek a second trial after a hung jury is really solely within the discretion of the prosecutor. And if the prosecutor wanted to move forward, the judge would not have the legal authority to be like, eh, I don't think that's a good idea. Eh, I don't like this case. Eh, I don't think you're going to win. None of those things would be in effect. And the prosecutor would have the sole decision-making
power.
Is there
a limit about how many times it can retry a case?
I don't know that there is a specific number that the law talks about. However, there are legal grounds like a speedy trial. They have a speedy trial right. They have a due process right to not be to not have a harassing prosecution. And maybe after the second one, they could argue, hey, this is just harassment at this point. This is vexatious. And so there are kind of ways to limit the number of retrials. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. What sort of appetite does a prosecutor typically have after a case like this? We saw Karen Reed got retried, and we know how that went. Also a Massachusetts case. When you have essentially the same set of facts, you're going to have essentially the same pool of people that you're going to be picking in for. So your odds of having a few holdouts here or there and ending with the same sort of jury, extremely high. I mean, the appetite is got to be considered. But even beyond that, because obviously they can redo it if they so have the appetite. But the defendant herself, Lindsay Clancy, she could ask for a bench trial, could they not? And if you were Reddington, having gone through this once, knowing the state of your client, do you go down that road?
So a few things. My understanding is that under Massachusetts law, if there is a first-degree murder charge, that has to go to a jury.
You're right.
Now, if it's a lesser – now, for example, if the jury came back not guilty on first-degree murder but hung on manslaughter or something, my understanding is that a manslaughter charge could go to only a judge. Now, that's risky on the defense side because when you're talking about a jury, you got 12 people. You need to convince at least one of them to vote not guilty, and then you get at least a hung jury. If you convince all of them, you win. But when you have a judge, you only have one person, not 12, who you got to hope sides would side with you. And so the judge part is a little bit more risky just in terms of the numbers game and how juries come down in terms of hung juries. A judge is never going to have a hung jury because it's one person.
Would Judge Sullivan be the guy that did it, or would they reassign a new judge to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure.
I got a stump on Eric on one. It's rare.
I think it'd be most appropriate to get a second judge because the first judge would be privy to all of the evidence from the first trial, but the decision isn't going to be made on the evidence of the first trial. It's going to be made on the evidence of the second trial, and there'd be a concern that the judge's mind might go back to the first trial. I think they'd need a new judge.
Yeah, that's why I was curious, just because Sullivan seemed to really his objections, I haven't looked up the stats on it. Man, I got to do that one. For the objections that were made, was he more like, how did he lean on his objections and what he sustained and didn't sustain in them? I was just curious.
Yeah.
It's a good thing we got the answer here, everybody. It's a fact. It's a scummy government MK Ultra mind control that made Prozac for this reason, and the mind control program, come on people, evil CIA government. Well, I'm glad all questions have been answered. We're good going forward.
Jesus. Yeah, the brain drain I've had in the last week has just been profound. You know, we were talking about this before the show, Eric, and that is, you know, when you do assessments of cases, and in my case, human beings, you know, it requires a massive amount of empathy, which isn't sympathy, it's empathy to understand the viewpoint from someone else from their shoes, which is very defense oriented as well, because you have to understand your client, you have to understand it's huge understanding, which means you typically, just by the nature of who you are, you listen to all these really, really stupid things to try to figure out where they're coming from. And so it just occupies massive brain space. So I just got to shut this shit down. It's killing me.
It is. I mean, it's been a mental workout on this case. One more in this lane before we talk about the crazed person who showed up with the camera. If you're a mother watching every day of this, looking for an answer, and this means a lot to a lot of people. What are you supposed to take away if the jury walks out without a verdict here? I mean, there's so much that seems to be riding on the verdict here in terms of understanding of mental health of women in postpartum situations. Is this really more so not necessarily an indictment of the medical system, but of our society and an understanding of this sort of world? If we're not able to come back with an answer either way.
Gosh, you know, one thing I could say for sure, in my opinion, is that you would see more of these types of defenses, especially with mothers who may have been going through a postpartum process and were alleged to commit a crime, especially if it's killing their children. You are going to see this type of defense much more regularly, and you're going to see experts popping up who support this kind of a defense. And so I think from a legalistic standpoint, we can sort of pin down what that effect might look like. From a societal or moral standpoint, gosh, that one is a big question. That is tough to tackle. I don't know. You know, if a mom kills their three kids, should they be able to get off some sort of hospitalization? It's a hard question.
But it's only in the state, too, because most of the states aren't as – I mean, the education on what the laws are when it comes to not guilty by reason of insanity or not criminally responsible, there's huge differences between states, massive. I mean, if this had happened in one of the four that don't even have this as a possibility of defense, then we wouldn't even be talking about this. And so that's what it's also pretty interesting about this and where this occurred, and
it's a false comparison. I've seen so many damn. I just did a monologue about this morning. Is the another Lindsay Clancy? I keep seeing that in headlines when there's basically a mother and dead children. The headline becomes "It's another Lindsay Clancy," and I think that's so insanely disingenuous because it's not. This is such a unique case. Postpartum psychosis is statistically a rare thing. I do wonder if it is more prevalent than we actually know statistically. But when we had, what was it? Andrea Yates. Comparisons going on here. People are like, well, Lindsay Clancy is going to make all these women run and claim this. We didn't see a giant uptick after Andrea Yates. No, it's not. That didn't change the landscape. Neither is this going to change the landscape. And when everyone keeps jumping onto this, this is going to start the precedent of more mothers doing this. No, it's not. I mean, everybody's saying it's another Lindsay Clancy, just as they did for the last 20 years, another Andrea Yates. And you look at the case details and it's like, no, these are really nothing.
And here's why it won't be and hasn't been before. And that's why this one's so unique. So a lot of people say anyway that the experts cancel themselves out, even though they agree in a lot of areas with her mental health issues. Just their definitions of what the individual psychologists are saying was criminal responsible is their own context from the laws in their own states as well. So that's why it's a little bit of moving target. But they all agreed on a lot of things, not all of them on the postpartum psychotic spot of it, but all the mental health issues, yes. And so here's what's extremely unique in this case. It's remove the doctors and their opinions and their analysis and all that. The huge difference is her and her family, the support network around her that gives all the other data points for the jury to use in their deliberation. In other words, all these other cases where people are going to be a lot more Lindsay Clancy's. Really? Have you seen this many people on any other case that stood by the defendant that actually were part of the family that lost their kids and said, we stand by her. She's not, this wasn't in her right mind. There's something wrong here. Coworkers, family, loved ones, ex-husbands, all of them are saying exactly the same thing. That's what makes this one extremely unique. Because do your own thought experiment. If you're one of these rare people, comes from a very, very healthy family, as my wife said to me the other day, if you had done this to our kids, There's no way in living hell I would have thought that was you. Something had to be going wrong in your life. Some psychotic break or something, because that is not you. So that's what makes this one unique.
Yeah, I agree. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy trial. And Todd, I know you're watching in the background. If we have anything that breaks during this, let us know. I know that jury is still out as of right now, but if we need to jump into anything, we can. Ta-da! In game show fashion, the response. The Lindsey Clancy trial continues to be one of the most heartbreaking and emotionally exhausting cases we've ever covered. Right now, we're watching a jury struggle in real time, deadlocked after days of deliberation. By the time you're watching this, we very likely will have an answer, and that answer may be a hung jury. Trying to untangle the devastating reality of postpartum psychosis versus premeditated murder. But as the stakes inside the courtroom, if they weren't high enough, the circus outside just breached the perimeter. A 56-year-old woman was arrested outside the Plymouth courthouse this week, accused of secretly filming the jurors as they left. She told reporters she just wanted to see Lindsey. But police found deleted videos of the jury on her phone. Eric Faddis is with us, defense attorney, former prosecutor, to help us discuss this along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. It's a madhouse. I don't know another way to put it. Every time we see the coverage outside of a trial these days, it reminds me of my days working in radio outside of a concert, where you'd have your tent outside and sometimes you'd have a promotion going, come by, win a t-shirt. It feels like that. And that's weird to me when you're talking about three dead kids and this atmosphere. But it is what it is. I mean, we can criticize it all day. People are very up in arms about this. They're passionate. Passion's not a bad thing, but when it gets misdirected, when it gets crazed, when it gets dangerous, when it gets expository of people who are just trying to do their jobs, like jurors showing up for their duty, being filmed, it gets a little scary. The immediate threat, the deadlock, Eric, this jury was already struggling towards a potential deadlock and feeling the immense weight of this case before this woman was arrested in the parking lot. The judge actually had to question them one by one about it before they could resume deliberations. Practically speaking, I mean, how does an outside disruption like that push an already fragile, exhausted jury towards, you know, a decision of some sort? And I mean, we'll get to the fallout of what that could possibly mean, depending on what that decision is. But how do you react to that as either a prosecutor or a defense attorney when something like this occurs?
Sure. So there are a number of issues at play. One is possible juror intimidation. Another is a juror's perception that someone might be intimidating them, even if that wasn't the original intent. You know, look, these jurors, it's such a high stakes case. You know, we have three dead children and they've got a horribly difficult decision to make. They didn't sign up for this. And they want to keep their identities anonymous because think about the backlash that could come from their decision. Either way, there's yeah. Extremists on both sides who could lodge threats and God knows what. And so I think it's a significant intrusion into the integrity of the jury system. And I worry that these jurors might be concerned for their own safety. Who's going to out me? Who's going to post a video of me online? Yeah. And then if I let this lady off, is somebody going to come to my door and not be too happy about that? Those are some very real concerns. And I think they also give rise to a possible appellate ground if there is a
concern. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, the judge immediately asked them all, polled them all, basically, you know, said, did this woman's, did she affect you in any way, shape, or form? I mean, basically, a line of questioning was done and swore them all back in after the event. They all have answered that are back in the jury room. No, we're good. That's lovely and all, but does that make a damn bit of difference? Should whatever verdict comes out here, I mean, let's play some scenarios. Let's play this scenario. They find her guilty. Let's say they find her guilty, and 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, a day later, whatever, sometime later, one of those jurors does an interview with somebody, and something comes out of their mouth to the effect of, yeah, I voted for that because I was afraid for my safety. and for whatever reason that they've thought that decision would actually keep them as safe as they could. May not be what they fully believe, but they were pressured into it because of that action. Wasn't another juror, wasn't Becky Hill going to another precinct and weighing in. It was this event. And even though they told the judge, I'm okay, I really did feel this way. What does that do to a verdict, even though it's already rendered and they're sworn in?
I think that is likely an automatic reversal. The jurors cannot base their determination on any information or force or dynamic outside of what happened when the evidence was presented within that courtroom. And so if they felt some kind of pressure and that contributed even to a very slight degree in their final determination, and even if they said before under pressure when you're being basically interrogated by a judge in this very serious case, and they said, no, I'm fine, that doesn't necessarily alleviate the potential appellate concerns if there is a conviction and a juror did feel pressure. And that's a very real concern in this case. Those jurors in the back, think about how acrimonious it can be at like a work meeting when you have like 30 minutes and you're trying to come to a decision. These people have been doing it for days and days and days. And that pressure is very high as it is.
Do you think it was, I know logistically it's challenging, especially for 3 to 5 weeks of your life. Should they have been sequestered during this?
Sequestration, I think there's been a trend away from that. It's so burdensome for the jurors who, again, didn't sign up for this. They're just doing their civic duty. And to, put them in a hotel where they typically can't have much contact with family, friends, work, things like that. I think that is a bit overkill. And I think that the risks and costs of that process probably outweigh the benefits in my mind.
Yeah. What is the bar these? Because you don't see it that often these days. Sequestration, where they're in the hotel like that. If people don't understand what that means, it means you're not going home. You're not hanging out with your friends and your family. You're not watching. They're really, really making sure you're not getting access to this. And that's what's the bar that's keeping it is control. What is the bar though these days? What kind of cases? What does it take to qualify for a sequestered jury?
The judge has a ton of discretion there. So the judge is kind of the steward of the jury. The judge has to look out for the jury and also has to make sure they're not being improperly influenced. And so usually that threshold is just sort of the judge's subjective opinion in terms of, is there a risk that outside information and influence could creep in to this jury process during this trial? Is that risk high enough to justify the burdens of sequestration? And I think judges are trending away from that. And I really haven't, I can't recall the last time I've actually seen a judge decide, hey, yes, we need to sequester for this entire trial. And so that just goes to show how difficult it is to obtain that.
Unless you're in the reality show Jury Duty that's on, what was that?
That's true.
They sequestered him in that.
That was a good one. Crazy. I want to go back to the, what if scenario here. So we talked about if a juror comes back on somebody's podcast and says, I felt pressured and this is why I voted this way or that way. But more so, I mean, it would be more effectual if it was I voted guilty. What happens here, though, if no juror says anything at all? I mean, does Reddington have a card to play regardless because of this incident, if they have to go to appeal, if they were to be in that sort of a situation?
That's tougher. I think that would be much more difficult for the defense. And usually what often happens in a case like this, if there is a guilty verdict, defense will ask to interview each one of those jurors. Thing is, though, Tony, these jurors do not have to subject themselves to this to an interview with defense counsel or anyone. In fact, they're given an instruction at the end of the trial that basically says, hey, if you don't want to talk about this, man, you don't have to. And no one's going to force you unless there's like a hearing and you're subpoenaed. But so you really need something from the jury. You can't just say like, oh, there was the appearance of outside influence because that lady tried to film them. That probably isn't enough. You probably need some morsel, at least, from a juror saying, yeah, I noticed that. And yeah, I think it did have an effect.
What if, because again, going to what Reddington has in his tool bag in case it doesn't go the way he wants it to go, and you don't have a juror saying that, but since they had the mistrial request, you know, when they were invoking religion and religiosity and that, can he go back and use that as a threat? So even though it was sustained and the jury was given very strict instructions by Sullivan not to listen to those words, can he still then claim it had an impact since it was heard by the jury and use that as a grounds for appeal?
He can certainly argue, but at the appellate level, there is a presumption, a legal presumption, that the jurors will follow the instructions of the court. So if the court said, hey, I know you all heard this, can't unring that bell, but you can't consider it, there's a presumption that the jury will not consider it. So you have to, as defense counsel, try to unearth some kind of contrary evidence to that, that either they did consider it. And, you know, if they're talking on a podcast later and they're talking about how significant they thought that religiosity issue was, that those kinds of things might be enough.
So are jurors then, after cases especially like this one, given really clear and good instructions by the court about what they should or shouldn't do, or what they're allowed to do or not allowed to do, and is it legally binding?
Do you mean before the deliberations or after the case is done?
Like after the case is done, like we're talking out all these hypotheticals on what jurors could or potentially say either to news, podcast, something like that, which could actually upend and flip things around or bring attention to things. In other words, just on this case, on this one with, you know, invoking, what was the statement? Not wrath of God or
mortal sin.
The mortal sin statement. You know, so are they instructed about how to conduct themselves after, and is it legally binding if they are?
In every trial I've done, and I've done more than 60, the judge has a very limited instruction at the end of the jurors saying, thank you so much for your service. If you want to talk about this with somebody, you can. And if you don't, you don't have to. And if someone is pressuring you to do something you don't want to do, like talking about the case, bring it to the judge's attention. That's pretty much it. So that's pretty broad. That allows the jury kind of to – it's in their hands. They can do what they want. And some jurors want to talk about it. Others want to get it behind them.
And jurors, I mean, in a high-profile case like this, the reality is going to be there is a potential payday there for any one of them. If they'd like it to be, I can guarantee if you want a book deal, you'll get a book deal. If you want there, I mean, it is what it is. And I don't know if there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I guess it probably depends on how one is using that, whether it's, you know, in a way of trying to, you know, spread a message of some sort of awareness for the greater good, or just to cash in on the death of three children. There's two kind of lanes there that could take. But the possibility is there. So we're inevitably going to hear from some of them. And I mean, it'll be fascinating. When we do hear from some of them, Eric, just pure conjecture, what do you think that conversation's going to be like? What do you think we're going to hear really from any of them when they're describing what was going on over these however many days, roughly 30-some hours in that jury room?
I can't even imagine. I could go back to an example of, like, let's say you at work are trying to decide on what you're going to have for lunch. And there's like three different positions and someone's like, no, I want pizza. And it's like, no, that's unhealthy. Let's get Japanese or whatever. You know, that sometimes it's hard to reach a consensus on something as simple and trivial as that. And that could take, you know, 10 minutes or something like that. The amount of time that these jurors have been going back and forth with each other in what I'm sure is an emotionally charged environment with deeply held beliefs that implicate ideas of motherhood, of mental health, of women's health. People have strong positions about those things. And I bet that many of them are vocal about just how zealously they believe one thing or the other. And so I bet it is, you know, that's not the right, I was going to say a different word, but it's definitely a difficult, difficult scenario back there. Tense, acrimonious at times, I imagine.
I can't even imagine the mental exhaustion they're under right now. So the biggest energy draw in our entire bodies, believe it or not, is the brain. And when you actually keep exercising your brain that hard for that long, for that sustained period of time, I can't imagine how emotionally and mentally exhausted these people are. I know people are putting in the comments too, and we've all said it. I wouldn't pay anything to be on this jury. You know, at the very end, so I'd love to be part of this, kind of see everything that's going on. No freaking way. I really, hats off to them on this one. This is a rough one to be part of because it's impacting them for the rest of their lives, as if we know it would have, but also just the emotional toll this has taken, no doubt. Do they offer, actually, I don't think so, but I'll just throw it out to you anyway, Eric. Do they offer counseling to jurors after things like this? I mean, they have seen some really horrendous things. They've been through a lot of trauma just going through deliberations on this, I'd imagine, much more so than if you're on a jury for a traffic stop. You know, if there is such one, obviously, probably not. But, you know, there's a lot they're going through, a lot they're exposed to. You know, you're getting only a sense of it by looking at people are breaking down in the courtroom, but this is a lot for a human being to go through, and this wasn't something they've even volunteered to go through. Anything offered to them as counseling or anything?
Nada, to my knowledge. That it's not sucks. Something the government would pay for. Is there a need for it? Is there a reason for it? Probably. But to my knowledge, thought. I've never heard a court.
we're kind of playing the like what if scenario game. Has everyone, just curious, completely kind of off topic, but has anyone ever raised a claim against a state for putting them through a trial that like scarred them emotionally and their like mental health medical bills? I mean, it seems like it could be a logical one for some of the shit that a juror has to endure.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've never heard of such a claim, and I think the government would have significant protection and immunity, in part because it's enshrined within the laws that the jurors have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it would be a very, very different scenario, but would it be akin to almost a law enforcement officer or someone in the armed services coming back and suing the police department or the army because while they were doing their sworn duty, they encountered things that were traumatizing? You don't really see that. That doesn't really exist. Is this kind of in that same vein because it is a duty as a citizen that we're asked to participate in? So that kind of washes the hands of whatever the government exposes you to. It's like, good luck.
You know, yes and no, Tony. One thing that comes to mind is the Vietnam War. So there was a lawful draft. So the law said these folks had to participate. Yeah. And then some of them over there were exposed to Agent Orange, were exposed to other noxious chemicals that could, in their position, have a lasting physical impact. So the emotional piece alone, I think it probably doesn't get to any sort of viable claim, but it wouldn't be unprecedented for someone who was engaging in lawful activity required by the government and who sustained an injury to then try to make a claim after that, as many Vietnam vets did. And in fact, many of them were not, in my mind, treated fairly after that in terms of what they're exposed to.
So, yeah. So suing the Commonwealth, no, not in any realistic way. But counseling, yes, just for your factual pleasure. Massachusetts built this in 2022. The trial court launched a first-in-the-nation program, free short-term professional counseling for jurors distressed by service. 3 one-hour sessions by phone or video with a dedicated counselor. If they need more, the counselor refers out. The judge can also offer it to people who sat in on the pool and got wrecked by voir dire. I can't even pronounce that anymore. After ugly homicide trial, several jurors from the same panel have used it. So Massachusetts does offer it.
Hey.
Remarkable.
The more you know. Ba-dum-bum-bum.
So after the witch trial, they cancel you for the witch trial.
Yeah, that's great. They give you some candy. It's bring your trick-or-treat bag and they fill it up
for
you.
That's interesting, though. Yeah, I'm glad we asked that question.
Yeah, the true crime tourist epidemic is we've talked about it a bit. I mean, it exists. It's going to be there. Have the courts... Are they prepared? Do they need to be treating the outside security parameters and what goes on when the jury goes to their car with more security and safety than they have? Obviously, it's very different outside a courthouse than it was in 1996. And it still seems that a lot of the you know, the security measures in many cases are still about there. We've seen some that are really stacked up very well. But is that something, in your opinion, that could lead or could use a little catching up to today's culture and obsession with true crime, Eric?
Are you kidding me? Absolutely. I've seen some clips from outside of that courthouse where things appear to be basically pandemonium. And that is a real concern in terms of the effect it could have on the jury. It's a real concern for the safety of the proceedings. And then what they got to do is up the security measures, but also balance that with the folks' rights to a public trial, to free speech, to voice their opinion outside of the courthouse. And so you have a lot of competing interests that would be really hard to balance for like a courthouse security team, you know? And so kind of a Herculean effort with how much things have ramped up in this new era.
Yeah, that would it's scary to think about how one individual could very dramatically upend a trial. I mean, this one may have. I mean, look at what Becky Hill did with her things. This one woman outside of the courthouse just trying to take a picture. I mean, if people can do far worse than a camera. This case has such emotional vitriol connected to it. Were you surprised that a person got that close to a juror, was able to take pictures of the jurors getting to and from their cars? I mean, I know it's a courthouse. It's a public building. It's not like they have secret underground tunnels and a secret passageway to load people in and out of. But I don't know, more fencing. I mean, we're several weeks in here. We do know the effect this case has been having on the country. The fact that somebody even got that close, is that, I don't know. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised in part because I recently attended the trial in Colorado for the dentist Daniel Craig, who was convicted of causing the death of his wife. Yeah. And when you're sitting in the gallery, if you even bring out your phone, if you just bring it out of your pocket, security will ask you to leave. You cannot even be brandishing a phone within the vicinity of that trial. And so the fact that this person got close enough, was able to have her phone, it's operational, she's taken allegedly photos and videos, that seems like a bit of a breach to me. You know, I think there can be other measures taken, like, hey, this is a public trial, and if you want to watch it, cool, man, but you can't have your phone with you, like things like that. Those are reasonable restrictions that could be placed, but it appears hadn't been.
I thought we saw that, though. Didn't we see? I mean, that was my question at the onset of this, you know, because I think I watched every single minute of this trial, and they did a lot of panning of the gallery. I'm pretty sure I saw people with their cell phones. Matter of fact, some people that come on our show. I mean, because I thought I saw like reporters, podcasters actually taking their notes and everything. I was really curious because I know when I've gone to court in my own county, you got to leave that crap in the car. And even Reddington, now granted, I know he's, you know, one of the attorneys, but he's got his cell phone up on the table there with him as well. Yeah. What, you know, I guess, what the hell? I mean, were they allowed, not allowed? I mean, because like, how do you control that if you're allowing one guy to have it or multiple people to have it to not actually do a pan around? I mean,
In my experience, it's almost like a tiered structure of allowances. So folks who had press credentials in the Daniel Craig trial, they were allowed to bring their laptops. They could have their phones with them. I don't believe they could take their phones out, though. Whereas me, I did not have press credentials at that time. So I could not have my phone out. I could not have a laptop. I had to have an old school pen and paper to be taking stuff down. The attorneys themselves, they're allowed to usually keep all of their tech, and there's just little concern that they're going to violate the rules. But it's kind of a tiered structure in that sense, yeah. In my experience.
It's almost there's too much of an honor system at play these days. And it feels like what used to work, people just, you know, don't chase down the jury and take their pictures, is the strong suggestion of it is no longer working. It's scary. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to discuss the Lindsay Clancy case. The Lindsey Clancy trial is reaching its climax. A hung jury appears to be increasingly likely. A mistrial would mean the charges remain, the evidence remains, and the woman at the center of all of it is still sitting at Tewksbury Hospital waiting to find out what the Commonwealth of Massachusetts plans to do. It looks like nobody is going to get a clear verdict from this trial if that's where it goes. Not the public, not the families, not Lindsey Clancy herself. Today, we're joined by defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis to walk us through the potential road ahead if a mistrial is in fact declared, how quickly we'd know if there's a second trial, whether the defense has options nobody's talking about, and what a plea deal even looks like in a case where the whole argument is that the defendant wasn't responsible for what she did. Eric, if a mistrial is officially declared and the jury is sent home, what happens to Lindsey Clancy? Is it true? Does she just go back to Tewksbury and they figure out what happens next, or until the next hearing or trial? What are the possibilities there? I guess how quick does a DA decide we're going to try this again, go back to the hospital, or you're free?
Sure. So I don't think it's going to be a you're free outcome. I think what's going to happen if there is a mistrial, there are a number of steps that are going to take place. First, the judge is, unless the prosecution has already made the decision as to whether or not to retry, the judge would probably set a hearing like a week after the mistrial. Say, hey, prosecutor, you got a week. Think about this. Are you going to seek a retrial or not? If a retrial is sought, then Lindsey Clancy throughout that week and throughout the pendency of the retrial would probably remain in custody. My understanding is that she's at some mental health facility, but under like law enforcement supervision. And so she could ask for a bond. She could absolutely ask for a bond, and Reddington could go to the judge and say, hey, look, this case, it shows how many weaknesses there are in this case. You know, they had all of this time. They couldn't bring it together. They couldn't get a conviction. Because of these weaknesses, you should have less concern about Lindsey Clancy. She is probably going to prevail in the second trial, is what Reddington would argue. Therefore, you should give her a bond. You should let her be out of custody. She's already gone through this crucible. That's what defense would argue. I think a judge would be hard-pressed to release Lindsey Clancy pending a new trial. Now, if no new trial is sought, then there is no case pending. And in that instance, Lindsey might be free.
But what about her care, I guess, is the question. She's already stated before this trial, you know, I want to be essentially in state care or in a mental hospital for the rest of my life. That's kind of where that sits. Let me ask you this from a strategic standpoint. If we do have a hung jury, yes, Reddington could come say, you know, and ask for bond. That could get Lindsey out of Tewksbury. I don't know that Lindsey wants to be out of Tewksbury, or at least out of a environment where she is getting that sort of round-the-clock care. Right now it's state-sanctioned. It's state-paid for. If you're out of that, guess what? You better have the money to pay for that care for the rest of your life. And the optics, because if this does go to another trial and she's out on bond, half of the argument has been, look, she doesn't want to leave the mental hospital. If she left the mental hospital between trials, that kind of takes that argument away that actually does play in her favor. Wouldn't she be better off remaining in the psychiatric facility, at least through some sort of determination here in a legal sense, versus bonding out for a time being if we were to go to a second trial?
I think absolutely it would be in her best legal interest to be there, in part because it preserves that argument that, hey, she's doing everything she could. She's seeking all the treatment she can seek. Like, she's trying her darndest to get a grasp on this. It preserves that argument for defense later on. If she were released from the facility but wanted additional care, you can always seek to commit yourself. You can say, hey, I think I'm a danger to myself and others. State, help me. And sometimes you will be accepted into programs, sometimes not. So there are ways for her to remain in there if she wants to, but probably not forever unless that is the result of a legal proceeding.
Interesting.
And I'm looking up the stats on the probability of getting bail bond after this anyway, too. So stand by as it comes in.
Yeah. There's obviously, you know, the jury is signaling deep divisions here. The judge read them the Tui Rodriguez charge, which essentially tells the jury that no future panel will hear better evidence than they did. Okay. I mean, neat. If I'm on the jury and I hear that, I'm like, yeah, no shit. And they're still struggling. I know this is how it's done there in Massachusetts, reading that charge out to them. Does it make a difference? Does that, hey, guys, ain't going to get better than this. Does it put weight on a jury to make a decision? Or is it just like another no shit moment for the jury?
That is such a concern. It is the potential coercive effect from such an instruction. So let me give you an example. Let's say back there are 11 not guilty and one guilty. And this one guilty just firmly believes, hey, she is guilty. This is my determination as a juror after hearing everything. Well, if the jury then goes to the judge and says, hey, we're deadlocked. And the judge says, keep trying, go back. And then they come again. And they say, hey, judge, we're still deadlocked. We tried. It's not changing. And the judge says, why don't you go back? You're going to have to finish this. The jury doesn't necessarily know that if they go back a third time, a mistrial is likely to be determined. Instead, maybe that one holdout who thinks they're guilty just says, how am I getting out of here? I'm not getting out of here unless I change my position. I could be here, who knows, for days, weeks on end. Yeah. I've already been here for weeks and weeks and weeks. I'm going to cave. I'm just going to change. I got to go on with my life. And that is a very real concern, I think, for both sides in terms of the possible course of effect of that instruction.
How do you avoid that? I mean, so help me understand what this and what's the thing that he invoked, the judge, is that tomb, the Tewksbury?
Tewksbury Rodriguez, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So what exactly is that? And what are the consequences to the jurist at this point, if any?
Sure. So what that means, Robin, is that the jury goes and says we're deadlocked. The court says, hey, I get it, guys. This is tough. But no one is in a better position to decide this case. And what you should do is you should reconsider your views. You should be open-minded to other people's expression of their views. And you should not relinquish any strongly held beliefs if you firmly believe one thing or the other. So it's kind of just like, hey, keep thinking about it, bro. And, you know, how helpful is that? And what effect could that have on jurors who, like I said, they're not advised that if they come back a third time deadlocked, it's likely a mistrial. They don't even know that could be the outcome. And so the jurors are probably back there thinking, they're not going to let me out of here unless somebody caves and I got to get on with my life. And that would be a perversion of the jury system in my mind.
And so that couldn't be used by Reddington, but I'm learning from you, Eric. So that could not be used from Reddington as a reasons for appeal unless there's evidence that it actually did influence one. In other words, as long as they came back and they did all agree, Reddington has no appeal. Unless through a podcast interview or something, one of the jurors says, yeah, you know, when he came in the third time, I felt the pressure and I just wanted to get out of there. Is that then enough for a reason for appeal?
They would probably need some kind of statement from some juror, however limited, that said, hey, you know, I changed my mind in part because of the pressures that I felt associated with this instruction, associated with this process.
So I'll riff on that one deeper. Say there's a juror that is completely, or a couple, completely sick to death of being here, the stress, the time, the agony, the contentiousness, that says, hey, I'm going to end this right now by agreeing. And then in their mind, they said, and then I'm going to go public with it so they can retry and get my way.
That would be thoughtful in terms of forward thinking and in terms of a plan. But yes, a juror could choose to do that and then sort of upend the whole thing. We've seen cases upended by juror statements after trials before.
Has that happened? Have you seen that happen intentionally?
I can't say that I have, but there's gazillions of trials and I'm only aware of a very small percentage of them.
That's yeah. Yeah. I mean, that could, I mean, it would, I mean, couldn't truly be a strategy, because, I mean, if there was an attorney that was seen being involved with trying to get a juror, let me ask you that, a juror after the fact, not influencing the juror during the process, but after the fact, you're the attorney for the client, and you happen to get, there's a juror that comes to you from the last trial and says, you know what, I think this is bullshit, I want to speak out about it, and I just went along with this because this was my plan all along, does exactly what Robin just said, and you're the attorney for the other, what do you do with that information? Do you run with it? I mean, you're not the one who had this strategy. This juror decided to go rogue and try to take the law into their own hands and control the whole trajectory of this damn thing. I mean, does that just throw their credibility out, you know, immediately if they're doing that, or what? I don't know. This seems like it could be a very common scenario, considering the way that the world is viewing true crime and the fervor that people have for it.
Juror misconduct is one of the most frequent grounds on which convictions are overturned. And so a juror has some rules that they have to base their decision on the evidence and not on some strategy, not on some personal payoff that I get to get out of here, not on some, you know, thought that, oh, I'm going to get some attention or whatever after this if I do this kind of weird thing. I think it would qualify as juror misconduct and would likely result in some kind of reverse.
God. Yeah. So their misconduct, their goal of it would, I mean, could there be charges for a juror that does, that admits to doing something like that? I mean, are they really doing anything illegal? Other than just being,
we are flexing Eric's
being
legal
a
brain,
hindrance to society.
Right. That's not always a crime. I've got some friends who are major hindrances. Yeah. They're free. But, you know, I think I can't think of any sort of criminal action. It wouldn't be tampering.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be tampering with a juror because it's yourself and you're not exerting influence over somebody else. I don't see a crime in that. I don't know.
I'm still looking up the last one. My AI is running slow on this because I'm asking all about these crazy questions about the juror intentionally undermining the process so they could go home finally, so they could actually reverse it the way they wanted. So it's actually coming in right now. So keep going, Tony.
One more question. If this jury does come back hung, do we find out the final count, or does the judge decide if that information gets out?
I would be doubtful that the public would find out. Sometimes when there is a hung jury, both sides want to know what the count was. You know, if it was 11 not guilty, 1 guilty, that may cause a DA to not retry the case. Whereas if it was 11 guilty, 1 not guilty, that'd be a good grounds to retry it. So it's pretty common for the attorneys to learn the split if the judge permits it. Public, not so much.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so here's what I found out. Holdouts get worn down. They do this like we just described. What happens in those cases? Almost nothing, because once the verdict is taken and the poll is clean, courts will not let a juror undo it by saying, I caved or I plan to talk later. That's the no impeachment rule, internal pressure fatigue, wanting to go home. That stays inside the room. So it wouldn't work.
It happens, though.
They try.
Yeah.
Fascinating what ifs, aren't they?
It is a lot of what ifs. That's the choose your own adventure version of the case.
Choose your own
today.
Ending, right?
All right, that'll wrap it up. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Be sure to check out Robin's masterclass. It is available now. The link is going to be in the description. Robin.
Yeah, it's masterclass.com/Robin Dreek. It's all about behavior assessment and becoming the people everyone trusts. So if you're interested, check it out. Thanks.
All right, check that out. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. As always, thank you so much for being on and giving us your insight on Thursdays, as always. Until next time, for Eric, for Todd, and myself, I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, Lady Luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.